In the world service of the BBC, this is Zainab Badawi with NewsHour. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the latest diplomatic mission to Belgrade fails to break the deadlock. With NATO airstrikes looking more likely, we ask, just what will they achieve and does NATO have the right to act in this way? Also, as the fighting intensifies in Kosovo itself, tens of thousands of ethnic Albanians flee.
It seems as though these villages are falling like dominoes. One will be hit and the population will move to the next village, which is supposedly safe, which will then fall.
And as the United Nations sets up an inquiry into why it failed to intervene to stop the genocide in Rwanda, we examine why it acts in some places but not in others. First, the news in detail. It's read by Philip Cotterill.
The United States Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke has returned to the American Embassy in Belgrade after a second meeting with the Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic to try to persuade him to accept the international peace plan for Kosovo. It was not immediately clear whether the talks had ended or would resume later. A prominent member of Mr. Milosevic's Socialist Party has meanwhile reiterated Belgrade's opposition to the deployment of foreign troops in Kosovo. John Simpson reports from Belgrade.
The signs are not good. There was no substantial change of any kind in Mr. Milosevic's attitude during the first session of talks, and without a climb down of a sort which would be deeply humiliating for the Serbian side, it's hard to see a peaceful outcome. One Western diplomat here said this morning that Mr. Milosevic was such a wily negotiator, nobody could be certain what he'd do. But he admitted he was deeply pessimistic. In particular, he could see no sign that NATO had any long-term strategic aim. The possibility exists, too, that if airstrikes take place, Serbian forces will immediately start looking for revenge against civilians, particularly ethnic Albanians in Kosovo, but also elsewhere.
Thousands of ethnic Albanians fleeing the latest fighting in Kosovo have been arriving in the provincial capital, Pristina. The BBC correspondent in the city says it's the heaviest movement of refugees since the fighting began in Kosovo just over a year ago. The fighting has now spread to Pristina for the first time. One person was reported to have been killed when shooting broke out in several outlying districts on Monday night.
It was billed as President Milosevic's final chance to accept a peace deal over Kosovo or face NATO airstrikes. A last-ditch attempt by the US envoy Richard Holbrooke to persuade Mr. Milosevic to sign up to the accord. If this fails, it leaves the international community with no more diplomatic avenues to explore. The Yugoslav leader's obdurate stand has been backed by his parliament, which has been meeting to discuss the Kosovo peace offer. It too has categorically refused to accept the presence of NATO-led forces in Kosovo to police any deal. So, where does this leave matters now? Joining me on the line from Belgrade is our correspondent, Nick Thorpe. Nick, the signs don't really look very good, do they, for that meeting between President Milosevic and Richard Holbrooke?
They don't at all. No, as you said, the Serbian parliament too has been rather leaning in the direction we've seen in the past days that no foreign troops would be allowed. There was one speaker there, one senior official in particular, who was the leader of the Serbian delegation in Paris, Ratko Markovic, the deputy prime minister. He didn't seem to close the door entirely on foreign participation, on foreign troops in Kosovo even, but he said this was something parliament should vote on. But certainly the mood in the parliament this morning, and so far they've adjourned for lunch themselves now, is that is very much strongly opposed to airstrikes, very much supporting the position that President Milosevic appears to be taking in the talks.
Is it your feeling then that we've reached the end of the road for the talks?
I don't think we have reached the very end. Richard Holbrooke is still here, and it can even be conceived. It is even conceivable that the Russian Foreign Minister, Mr. Ivanov, might yet visit Belgrade as a kind of in injury time, as it were, in these awfully protracted negotiations. But that is pretty unlikely, and I think if Richard Holbrooke leaves without a signed piece of paper this time from President Milosevic, I think airstrikes would follow pretty soon.
Nick Thorpe in Belgrade, thank you very much. In Kosovo itself, the Serbs have stepped up their offensive, leading to the heaviest movement of refugees since the conflict began. Tens of thousands of Kosovo Albanians are on the move, 25,000 in just the last 3 days. This has put a huge strain on the humanitarian agencies working there. How have they been coping? Paula Gadini is a spokeswoman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Belgrade.
We're finding it exceptionally difficult, not only because of the ongoing fighting, which is preventing access to many of the crucial areas where we're finding most of the displacement, but also because we're finding ourselves among one of the few aid agencies that are still on the ground, as many have pulled back because of security reasons.
Give us an idea of just how bad the situation is on the ground.
For an example, over the weekend, during about a 48-hour period, we saw a displacement of approximately 25,000 people from the Srebrenica area, which is actually one of the largest escalations of displacement that we've seen since last spring. In addition to that, we're seeing a great deal of displacement in villages just on the suburbs of Pristina, and this is the first time that it has come so close to the capital of the Kosovo province itself.
There's fighting all over Kosovo. Where are these people actually fleeing to?
This is also another one of our concerns, because it seems as though these villages are falling like dominoes. One will be hit and the population will move to the next village, which is supposedly safe, which will then fall. And in turn, the displacement is leading to this mass displacement. And it seems quite unclear where the safe havens are. There are really no designated safe areas that remain safe for very long anymore.
What are conditions like for these fleeing people?
It is still a fairly harsh winter condition in many areas, especially the mountainous areas. In addition to that, just because the scale of fighting is so tense, you can hear shelling and automatic weapons and a lot of movement of military vehicles. The tension from not only seeing but hearing the fighting is so intense that we're finding that these people, many of whom have been displaced repeatedly since the beginning of the conflict last spring, are exceptionally traumatized. And I really believe that we're getting to a point where many of them are losing all sight of hope.
That was Paula Gadini, a spokeswoman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Belgrade, and we'll have more on this story later in the program. As the international community debates its next move over Kosovo, there are countless other conflicts in the world where the human suffering is also great, yet there seems to be a lack of will to stop the carnage. The civil wars we're seeing in Africa, for example, in Sierra Leone, the Congo, and the fierce war between Ethiopia and Eritrea, to name but a few. The effects of past failures to act are still apparent. Rwanda is a country where the tensions between the Hutus and the Tutsis in the mid-90s continue not only to mar that country's development, but have spilled over into neighbouring countries like Uganda. The present Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, was head of the UN's peacekeeping operations at the time of the Rwandan genocide and has long attracted criticisms for failing to order any intervention to disarm the Hutu militias. Around 1 million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed in the most brutal fashion, young, old and innocent alike. Now Kofi Annan is setting up an independent inquiry into the UN's failure to act in Rwanda. It withdrew its 2,000 peacekeepers there just as the genocide was about to begin. Fred Halliday is a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. What makes the international community act in one situation but not in another?
The interventions of the international community are some balance of principle and pragmatism. In other words, some balance of feeling that the situation is so dreadful in a country that they ought to do something, not just protest or impose sanctions or pass resolutions. But there has also to be a feeling that they can actually achieve something. And I think that means two things in particular. It means that states will only intervene when they also feel there's some national interest, and that includes domestic support for it. And they'll also secondly only intervene if they think they can make some difference. And the irony of that is that in the really dreadful situations, say Afghanistan or the Lebanese Civil War or Rwanda in 1994, the situation's so awful, they feel they can't do much. So we've tended to see interventions where actually the situation is less serious, but by that same token, maybe something can be done, like northern Iraq after the Gulf War or Haiti.
But is it right? Do you think the international community really couldn't make a difference in Rwanda?
The international community could certainly have made a difference, all the more so because this was a classic case of where there was forewarning. One of the lessons people have learned from other peacekeeping and humanitarian crises is that there should have been more forewarning, more foresight. Well, everybody knew this was coming. The problem was, and this is at the core of the problem of international institutions at the moment, is that no major state was in a position to say this is in our interest. Nobody felt they were willing to do so. after the Gulf War of 1991, the phrase was used, coalitions of the able and the willing. That's countries with a peacekeeping capability. And secondly, who actually were willing to get on with it and carry out the UN mandate in some way or another. The problem in Rwanda is there was the capability, but there was no will. And to use an awful phrase, which was used by the UN at the time, there were no takers for Rwanda. It was almost as if it's a market situation. Nobody actually wanted to buy into Rwanda, so it went down the tubes.
Do you think that now in the post-Cold War era, when we talk about the international community, we really mean the United States? If the United States doesn't have the will to intervene somewhere, then we don't see intervention.
It's not quite true it's just the United States. We see African states intervening under the OAU banner in West Africa. We see peacekeeping forces of the CIS, which means in large extent Russia, active in the Caucasus and in the Central Asian area. We see Arab League peacekeeping forces. But if we're talking about...
They don't quite have the clout, though, of US-led intervention.
But it isn't just the US. But having said that, if we're talking about major operations by major capable powers, and that means the British, the French, the Americans themselves, either the Americans go along and with it as they are over Kosovo, although saying that most of the troops shouldn't be American, or they in fact take the lead as they did over Kuwait. And anything that goes through the Security Council has to have at least tacit US support.
How important is the role of public opinion in mobilizing politicians to act?
The role of public opinion is very important, both in pushing politicians to act, but also in acting as a break. In other words, if you take the intervention in northern Iraq in 1991, public opinion, in part fueled by television pictures, in part fueled by general sympathy for the Kurds, played a role in getting politicians to act. But so did more hard-nosed factors, like Turkey's reluctance actually to take the refugees. Turkey wanted them to stay in Iraq, so instead of the West, go into Iraq to stop the refugees coming into Turkey. On the other hand, one of the major factors, in my view, behind the complete mess which the West has made over former Yugoslavia ever since 1991 is the lack of a clear public mandate for what may be risky peacekeeping operations. They dithered for 3 or 4 years over Bosnia because they didn't think they could take casualties. They're not sure whether they can really do what needs to be done over Kosovo, even as we speak. And therefore, the lack of a sense of strategic threat, the lack of a sense of national involvement, means that the armed forces and politicians are very reluctant to act. And this goes back to the lack of education of people in these international issues and in their responsibilities.
Professor Fred Halliday. Coming up in the next 30 minutes, as NATO airstrikes against Belgrade look like being increasingly on the cards, just what would they achieve? Also, does NATO have the right to bomb Belgrade? And how the United Nations is tackling the psychological traumas of children in Honduras after Hurricane Mitch. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Zainab Badawi with NewsHour. Now let's have a summary of world news. Here's Philip Cottrell.
The United States Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke has returned to the American Embassy in Belgrade after a second meeting with President Milosevic of Yugoslavia to try to persuade him to accept the international peace plan for Kosovo. It was not clear whether the talks had ended or would resume later. Thousands of ethnic Albanians fleeing the latest fighting in Kosovo have been arriving in the provincial capital Pristina. The BBC correspondent in the city says it is the heaviest movement of refugees since the fighting began in Kosovo just over a year ago.
Back now to our main story today. The failure so far of diplomatic efforts to gain compliance with the Kosovo peace deal from the Yugoslav president Slobodan Milosevic. This means the possibility of NATO airstrikes against Belgrade are becoming more likely by the hour. But what would they actually achieve? Paul Beaver is a defence specialist on Yugoslavia with Jane's Defence Weekly, and he's with me now. Paul Beaver, if these strikes were to actually go ahead, what would be targeted exactly?
I think the target list, which is probably about 500 individual locations long, is pretty well... We're pretty well able to anticipate what it must be. The air defences, because the whole of Serbia is integrated within one air defence system, which means there's an umbrella, if you like, across it. The command centres, and then I think a list of military targets, barracks, airfields, military production factories, because one of the aims is not just to stop the Serbian forces operating against the ethnic Albanians in Kosovo, but it's also to try and decimate their military capability and, who knows, perhaps get the military to put pressure on President Milosevic.
How well equipped is the Yugoslav army, Yugoslav defence forces to actually respond to such an attack?
Well, they are actually quite well prepared, even though there's been various embargoes against them. We believe that several countries countries have still been helping them, for example, Russia. They've got an integrated air defense system, unlike that that Saddam Hussein had in the Gulf, which is probably about the best, mirror of what we could expect. The system that the Serbs have is about a generation on from there. And they've got missiles which are virtually the same, but they have better guidance, better warheads, etc. So it's quite a formidable air defence umbrella that they have.
Let's look at what the airstrikes are actually meant to achieve. They're supposed to stop the Serb offensive in Kosovo on the ground. We already know there are tens of thousands of ethnic Albanians fleeing the fighting. Would NATO airstrikes achieve that?
Well, it'd be very difficult to individually destroy each tank and each police armoured car on the ground unless you had a large number of aircraft with forward air controllers based on the ground. You probably would want to attack helicopters as well. There's no sign of the latter. There may well be forward air controllers in special forces type individuals who are on the ground in Kosovo. But to target individual tanks is a long and laborious process. It may well be that some very impressive show destructions of heavy weapons will work. But knowing the Serbs, I don't think so.
So the only way to stop the Serb offensive in Kosovo, then, would it be to commit ground troops in addition to these airstrikes?
I think from the information I have at the moment, yes, it's to put ground troops into a position where they are stopping the VJ, the Serbian army, from attacking the Albanian civilians on the ground, and also, of course, stopping fighting between the KLA, the Kosovo Liberation Army, and the VJ. The last thing I think NATO wants to do is be seen as being the air arm of the KLA, so they want to make sure that it is a balanced approach.
Paul Beaver, thank you very much for joining us. Well, not all the mediators involved in the Kosovo negotiations are happy with the prospect of NATO airstrikes against Belgrade. Russia, in particular, has said it opposes the use of force, and it's reported that the Russian Prime Minister, Yevgeny Primakov, has said he'll cut short his visit to Washington in protest if any attacks are launched. Even a key NATO member like Italy has voiced its concerns that NATO may not have the legitimacy to act in this way against a sovereign state. With me also in the studio is our world affairs correspondent, John Lyne. John, does NATO have a mandate for airstrikes against a sovereign state like Yugoslavia?
What is quite clear here is there is no explicit UN authorization, as there was in resolutions before the Gulf War. And indeed, conversely, the UN Charter unambiguously grants states the right to self-defense. So that is all in Belgrade's favor. What Western leaders will say is there are resolutions like Resolution 1199 passed by the Security Council, which called on all sides to maintain a ceasefire and to avert humanitarian catastrophe in Kosovo. And that was passed under Chapter 7 of the United Nations, the enforcement chapter, talking about threats to international peace and security. And Western leaders also maintain now there is a developing right to intervene in humanitarian situations, as they have done in Iraq, with the no-fly zones.
But if NATO was formed, as we know, to protect Western Europe from the then Soviet Union, it really is exceeding its role, because, I mean, that's not the case at the moment.
Well, NATO actually expanded its charter to operate out of area, in fact, at an earlier stage in this Yugoslav crisis. So NATO has the technical mandate to do this. I think the concern for a lot of people is, whatever the explicit legal authorization there is for any future action here in Kosovo and in Serbia, if there isn't a UN mandate in black and white, that could really cause problems later down the line. Russia can use it to criticise it, and even domestic opinion might be difficult to bring on side if there are casualties in a prolonged operation and the UN hasn't explicitly endorsed this operation.
What is it then that has made NATO the sort of global policeman then, rather than the UN?
Well, quite simply, events. They have seen this situation here, and it's been a situation they have been unable to avoid dealing with, as happened earlier in Bosnia. They simply couldn't let this humanitarian catastrophe go on. It had geopolitical implications, and it simply had implications with the public opinion back home. And NATO is the tool. NATO is the only really available tool to act decisively in this situation.
It has the advantage, unlike the United Nations, which has to really discuss everything, doesn't it? I mean, NATO can act relatively quickly, whereas the UN Security Council has got to go through a series of discussions and resolutions.
The real problem, the simple problem here with the UN Security Council is that they would not get the resolutions through, they wouldn't get them past the Russians, they wouldn't get them past the Chinese vetoes. So they've got to act outside the UN framework, they've got to act, if not unilaterally, certainly without the agreement of the whole world community.
Do you think that countries like Italy, which have quietly voiced their concerns, do you think such concerns are going to increase if we do indeed see NATO airstrikes launch against Belgrade?
very much depends how an operation goes. Countries like Italy almost certainly can be brought on side at the beginning of an operation, but if it runs into problems, and if the strategy, the long-term strategy, is not seen to be clear, then doubts will be voiced louder and louder throughout Europe and throughout NATO.
John Lyne, thank you very much. Well, US warplanes continue to hit Iraq on an almost daily basis in response to what Washington says are Iraqi violations of the Western no-fly zones over the country. Baghdad talks of US and British aggression. The attacks have gone on since a four-day joint British-American campaign against Iraq in December, carried out in response to Iraqi efforts to block the work of UN weapons inspectors charged with dismantling the country's weapons of mass destruction. The Iraqis said the inspectors were spies. Now a BBC television programme, Panorama, has broadcast detailed allegations by a former weapons inspector, the ex-US Marine Scott Ritter, that Western intelligence did use the UN Special Disarmament Commission, UNSCOM, as a cover for their own activities. He also says the United States undermined UNSCOM. Our correspondent Nick Childs reports.
UN weapons inspectors blow up a biological weapons factory. In 7 years, UNSCOM uncovered huge amounts of banned Iraqi weaponry. But its work became increasingly difficult, as Iraqi officials like Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz claimed that it was ever more dominated by the United States and Britain and was used to spy on Iraq.
This is not a UN commission. Because of the dominance of the Americans and the British, it has been turned into actually an Anglo-Saxon, or rather an American agency with the support of the British.
That's a charge that's always been denied by Washington and London, and by Chief UN Weapons Inspector Richard Butler, who says UNSCOM had to turn to Western intelligence because of the huge efforts Iraq was putting into trying to deceive the inspectors.
It was clear that because of the wall of deceit, because of the degree to which Iraq had lied and sought to conceal, that we were then obliged to enter into the use of techniques that should not have been the case.
The issue is not whether Western intelligence helped UNSCOM in its legitimate mission. That's allowed under UNSCOM's mandate. Indeed, member states have an obligation to help the organisation. The question is whether US and British intelligence used UNSCOM as a cover to pursue their own ends, including trying to topple the Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein.
I know nothing. All I know is I want to go down this road, and I'm being told I can't.
Scott Ritter in typically confrontational mood on an inspection in Iraq. He became a particular focus of Iraqi hatred. But according to the Panorama program, he resigned in part because of the way US intelligence used UNSCOM to plant advanced listening devices to gather information and then withheld it from the inspectors.
In the end, the United States took over the whole program. UNSCOM wasn't in control of anything. We didn't know what was being collected. We didn't know how much was being collected, when it was being collected. We had no control over the process. That shows the corruption of the operation. It became a United States operation, not a United Nations operation.
That's an allegation strenuously denied both by Washington and Richard Butler.
I made very clear that I know exactly what I authorized by way of accepting technological assistance from countries, including the United States. I know what I rejected, and I know that what we did was always designed to implement our disarmament mandate and follow no one else's agenda.
But according to Panorama, Scott Ritter was in on at least one intelligence operation to prevent Iraq smuggling missile technology out of Romania, which Richard Butler was unaware of.
Is that a fact? Well, then perhaps you know something I don't know.
Critics of US policy say its use of UNSCOM information to target Iraqi sites in its air and missile campaign last December further undermined the organization. Scott Ritter's critics say he resigned because he was out of control and that his allegations have played into Saddam Hussein's hands and killed off UNSCOM.
I didn't kill UNSCOM. Richard Butler killed UNSCOM. The United States killed UNSCOM.
But his allegations have fueled the controversy surrounding the organization at a time when the West is still struggling to formulate a long-term policy for Iraq.
Nick Childs reporting.
From National Public Radio in Washington, D.C., this is special coverage of a live address by President Clinton. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Noah Adams. In a moment, the President will speak to the nation about today's airstrikes across Yugoslavia. This is the President's second statement of the day on the mission. At about 2 o'clock this afternoon, NATO forces began a first phase of attacks. Explosions were heard in Pristina, the capital of Kosovo, in Belgrade, the Yugoslav capital, and at other locations across Yugoslavia. NATO ordered the military attack after Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic refused to accept a peace plan for Kosovo, where guerrillas have been fighting for independence. That plan would give the Serbian province broad autonomy and would be enforced by 28,000 NATO troops. Yugoslavia has declared a state of war, and Russia has pulled out of the Partnership for Peace with NATO.
Some other important developments today. Russia has called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council to respond to what it sees as illegal NATO aggression. Earlier today, President Clinton called Russian President Boris Yeltsin to try to calm the anti-NATO rhetoric in Moscow. The House and the Senate are promising to pass quickly resolutions supporting American troops taking part in the mission. And as the bombers were on their way to Yugoslavia, President Milosevic said that his country would defend itself by all means. Here's the president.
Forces joined our NATO allies in airstrikes against Serbian forces responsible for the brutality in Kosovo. We have acted with resolve for several reasons. We act to protect thousands of innocent people in Kosovo from a mounting military offensive. We act to prevent a wider war, to defuse a powder keg at the heart of Europe that has exploded twice before in this century with catastrophic results. And we act to stand united with our allies for peace. By acting now, we are upholding our values, protecting our interests, and advancing the cause of peace. Tonight, I want to speak with you about the tragedy in Kosovo and why it matters to America that we work with our allies to end it. First, let me explain what it is we are responding to. Kosovo is a province of Serbia in the middle of southeastern Europe, about 160 miles east of Italy. That's less than the distance between Washington and New York, and only about 70 miles north of Greece. Its people are mostly ethnic Albanian and mostly Muslim. In 1989, Serbia's leader, Slobodan Milosevic, the same leader who started the wars in Bosnia and Croatia and moved against Slovenia in the last decade, stripped Kosovo of the constitutional autonomy its people enjoyed, thus denying them their right to speak their language, run their schools, shape their daily lives. For years, Kosovars struggled peacefully to get their rights back. When President Milosevic sent his troops and police to crush them, the struggle grew violent. Last fall, our diplomacy, backed by the threat of force from our NATO alliance, stopped the fighting for a while and rescued tens of thousands of people from freezing and starvation in the hills where they had fled to save their lives. And last month, with our allies and Russia, we proposed a peace agreement to end the fighting for good. The Kosovar leaders signed that agreement last week. Even though it does not give them all they want, even though their people were still being savaged, they saw that a just peace is better than a long and unwinnable war. The Serbian leaders, on the other hand, refused even to discuss key elements of the peace agreement. As the Kosovars were saying yes to peace, Serbia stationed 40,000 troops in and around Kosovo in preparation for a major offensive and in clear violation of the commitments they had made. Now they've started moving from village to village, shelling civilians and torching their houses. We've seen innocent people taken from their homes, forced to kneel in the dirt and sprayed with bullets. Kosovar men dragged from their families, fathers and sons together, lined up and shot in cold blood. This is not war in the traditional sense. It is an attack by tanks and artillery on a largely defenseless people whose leaders already have agreed to peace. Ending this tragedy is a moral imperative. It is also important to America's national interest. Take a look at this map. Kosovo is a small place, but it sits on a major fault line between Europe, Asia, and the Middle East, at the meeting place of Islam and both the Western and Orthodox branches of Christianity. To the south are our allies, Greece and Turkey. To the north, our new democratic allies in Central Europe. And all around Kosovo, there are other small countries struggling with their own economic and political challenges, countries that could be overwhelmed by a large new wave of refugees from Kosovo. All the ingredients for a major war are there. Ancient grievances, struggling democracies, and in the center of it all, a dictator in Serbia who has done nothing since the Cold War ended but start new wars and pour gasoline on the flames of ethnic and religious division. Sarajevo, the capital of neighboring Bosnia, is where World War I began. World War II and the Holocaust engulfed this region. In both wars, Europe was slow to recognize the dangers, and the United States waited even longer to enter the conflicts. Just imagine if leaders back then had acted wisely and early enough. How many lives could have been saved? How many Americans would not have had to die? We learned some of the same lessons in Bosnia just a few years ago. The world did not act early enough to stop that war either. And let's not forget what happened. Innocent people herded into concentration camps. Children gunned down by snipers on their way to school. Soccer fields and parks turned into cemeteries. 250,000 people killed, not because of anything they had done, but because of who they were. 2 million Bosnians became refugees. This was genocide in the heart of Europe, not in 1945, but in 1995. Not in some grainy newsreel from our parents' and grandparents' time, but in our own time, testing our humanity and our resolve. At the time, many people believed nothing could be done to end the bloodshed in Bosnia. They said, well, that's just the way those people in the Balkans are. But when we and our allies joined with courageous Bosnians to stand up to the aggressors, we helped to end the war. We learned that in the Balkans, inaction in the face of brutality simply invites more brutality. But firmness can stop armies and save lives. We must apply that lesson in Kosovo before what happened in Bosnia happens there too. Over the last few months, we have done everything we possibly could to solve this problem peacefully. Secretary Albright has worked tirelessly for a negotiated agreement. Mr. Milosevic has refused. On Sunday, I sent Ambassador Dick Holbrooke to Serbia to make clear to him again, on behalf of the United States and our NATO allies, that he must honor his own commitments and stop his repression or face military action. Again, he refused. Today, we and our 18 NATO allies agreed to do what we said we would do, what we must do, to restore the peace. Our mission is clear: to demonstrate the seriousness of NATO's purpose so that the Serbian leaders understand the imperative of reversing course, to deter an even bloodier offensive against innocent civilians in Kosovo, and if necessary, to seriously damage the Serbian military's capacity to harm the people of Kosovo. In short, if President Milosevic will not make peace, we will limit his ability to make war. Now, I want to be clear with you. There are risks in this military action, risks to our pilots and to people on the ground. Serbia's air defenses are strong. It could decide to intensify its assault on Kosovo or to seek to harm us or our allies elsewhere. If it does, we will deliver a forceful response. Hopefully, Mr. Milosevic will realize his present course is self-destructive and unsustainable. If he decides to accept the peace agreement and demilitarize Kosovo, NATO has agreed to help to implement it with a peacekeeping force. If NATO is invited to do so, our troops should take part in that mission to keep the peace. But I do not intend to put our troops in Kosovo to fight a war. Do our interests in Kosovo justify the dangers to our armed forces? I've thought long and hard about that question. I am convinced that the dangers of acting are far outweighed by the dangers of not acting, dangers to defenseless people and to our national interests. If we and our allies were to allow this war to continue with no response, President Milosevic would read our hesitation as a license to kill. There would be many more massacres, tens of thousands more refugees, more victims crying out for revenge. Right now, our firmness is the only hope the people of Kosovo have to be able to live in their own country without having to fear for their own lives. Remember, we asked them to accept peace, and they did. We asked them to promise to lay down their arms, and they agreed. We pledged that we, the United States, and the other 18 nations of NATO would stick by them if they did the right thing. We cannot let them down now. Imagine what would happen if we and our allies instead decided just to look the other way as these people were massacred on NATO's doorstep. That would discredit NATO, the cornerstone on which our security has rested for 50 years now. We must also remember that this is a conflict with no natural national boundaries. Let me ask you to look again at a map. The red dots are towns the Serbs have attacked. The arrows show the movement of refugees, north, east, and south. Already, this movement is threatening the young democracy in Macedonia, which has its own Albanian minority and a Turkish minority. Already, Serbian forces have made forays into Albania, from which Kosovars have drawn support. Albania has a Greek minority. Let a fire burn here in this area, and the flames will spread. Eventually, key U.S. allies could be drawn into a wider conflict, a war we would be forced to confront later, only at far greater risk and greater cost. I have a responsibility as president to deal with problems such as this before they do permanent harm to our national interests. America has a responsibility to stand with our allies when they are trying to save innocent lives and preserve peace, freedom, and stability in Europe. That is what we are doing in Kosovo. If we've learned anything from the century drawing to a close, it is that if America is going to be prosperous and secure, we need a Europe that is prosperous, secure, undivided, and free. We need a Europe that is coming together, not falling apart, a Europe that shares our values and shares the burdens of leadership. That is the foundation on which the security of our children will depend. That is why I have supported the political and economic unification of Europe. That is why we brought Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic into NATO and redefined its missions and reached out to Russia and Ukraine for new partnerships. Now, what are the challenges to that vision of a peaceful, secure, united, stable Europe? The challenge of strengthening a partnership with a democratic Russia that, despite our disagreements, is a constructive partner in the work of building peace. The challenge of resolving the tensions between Greece and Turkey and building bridges with the Islamic world. And finally, the challenge of ending instability in the Balkans, so that these bitter ethnic problems in Europe are resolved by the force of argument, not the force of arms, so that future generations of Americans do not have to cross the Atlantic to fight another terrible war. It is this challenge that we and our allies are facing in Kosovo. That is why we have acted now, because we care about saving innocent lives, because we have an interest in avoiding an even crueler and costlier war, because our children need and deserve a peaceful, stable, free Europe. Our thoughts and prayers tonight must be with the men and women of our armed forces who are undertaking this mission for the sake of our values and our children's future. May God bless them, and may God bless America.
President Clinton in the Oval Office describing the rationale for today's NATO strikes at targets throughout Yugoslavia, giving the reasoning for why NATO has taken action in light of Serbia's refusal to sign the Rambouillet Agreement on autonomy in Kosovo province. You've been listening to live coverage of the President's address to the nation on today's actions in Yugoslavia on NPR, National Public Radio. Joining us to talk now a bit about what the president just said and how he said it is Ivo Dalder, who is at the Brookings Institution, formerly on the National Security Council staff, in the Clinton White House, I might add. What would you say, a forceful speech, in your view, describing why we're doing this?
Yeah, I think so. It was a speech that laid out both the reasons for going in with the airstrikes that we started this afternoon, and also what the stakes are, and laying for the first time a real foundation for understanding what we are trying to do here. He made two, I think, important points. One is that the Albanians have, in essence, put their fate in our hands by signing the peace agreement, by agreeing in the end to disarm if that was if the peace agreement was going to be implemented. And we have now not only a moral but a strategic obligation to help these people.
Yes, and on radio, of course, we couldn't convey the two maps that the president invoked during his talk, but he was trying to point out that in the immediate vicinity of Kosovo are many other countries, and the conflict could spread and become a broader conflict in the Eastern Mediterranean. He did say at one point that really we should have that we did wrong in Bosnia. There was an admission, really, that all of the things he cited that had happened in Bosnia that might happen again. He seemed to be saying the world missed its opportunity to act soon enough there.
Yeah, and I think that's true. The Bosnian War was predicted in 1991. It happened in 1992, and we did see the concentration camps that the president talked about, and we did see the kind of horrific nightmare that we had thought that we were not going to see anymore since the end of World War II in Bosnia. And the United States and its allies basically stood by until 1995, when the kind of decision was made that we are now making here, to bomb if necessary, but to get to peace if possible.
This statement by the president did not describe at all today's airstrikes. No detail whatever. We'd heard something from the Pentagon earlier today. And it didn't dwell very heavily on exactly what must happen for all this to end.
No, and this is one of the things that is worrisome. The objectives that are laid out here remain quite vague. There is the hope still, I believe, in the administration and NATO that after some airstrikes, Mr. Milosevic will come to his senses. It really hasn't answered the question yet of what happens if he doesn't.
One answer, of course, is that NATO will just keep on doing this week after week after week. But then there is another question, which is, should ground forces be introduced into Kosovo?
Well, and then even the question is, if one were to do this for weeks and weeks and weeks, and if we were to put ground forces in, what's the purpose of doing so? Mm-hmm. If the purpose is to help the Kosovar Albanians, who have declared after a year of suffering horrendous attacks by Serb forces that they want to be independent, are we ready to use our air power and perhaps our ground forces to protect what will become, in that case, a quasi-independent, if not a real independent state of Kosovo? That is the question that hangs above the address of the president tonight.
Ivo Dalder of the Brookings Institution, formerly of the National Security Council staff.
Let's go now to Belgrade and talk to NPR's Edward Lifson. Edward, it's 2 a.m. there now? Edward, can you hear me? Hello, we're trying to talk to Edward Lifson in Belgrade.
Hello, Noah.
Hey, you can hear me now.
Yes, amazingly so.
Yes, it's. I was saying it's, 2 a.m. there now?
That's right.
What has the evening been like from your perspective?
Well, it's been quite tense. At about 8 p.m. local time was the first wave of the bombing that could be felt even from here in the center of Belgrade. We saw bright orange flashes in the sky. Some seemed to be about, 15, 20 miles from Belgrade. There were four or five of those at first, and then 40 minutes later at about 8:40 local time, there were another about five more. Many explosions out near the military airport. It did look like targets were being hit. People are very tense. People are wondering why America is doing this to them.
And is the power still on in Belgrade?
The power is on in Belgrade, yes. There are just a few cars on the street, not many.
We had talked to a New York Times reporter earlier who was in Pristina, and there were explosions there at the airfield, and in fact the power had gone off in Pristina, the capital city of Kosovo. What's on the television? What are the people being told today and this evening?
State television is giving extensive details of the air raids. They're saying that 20 installations in 7 towns all across Serbia and Yugoslavia, including Montenegro, were hit. The general staff of the Yugoslav army has issued its first statement about these bombings. They're saying they grossly violate the sovereignty and the integrity of Yugoslavia. The television is running pictures of the destruction over and over again.
And the what do you think is going to be the reaction of the people that you've met there in Belgrade?
Well, the reaction in Belgrade is what's especially worrisome because, you know, a state of war has been declared here, and that's the highest level of state of emergency possible in Yugoslavia. Civil freedom, civil liberties here can be drastically cut back. That would mean independent newspapers would be shut down. The main independent radio station, B92, has already been shut down. But more worrisome is that intellectuals, opposition members fear detention. People talk about this country imploding, saying that it's been waiting to implode for a decade even. And the fear is, of course, of these NATO airstrikes, but also of how the government and other people in power here, seeking power, will react. I should tell you also that some of this crackdown has already begun on the roof of a downtown hotel where many foreigners stay and many journalists stay. About 20 journalists were detained tonight. They were taken by the police for filming from the rooftop of this hotel, filming these bombing raids. And they've been gone for more than 4 hours now. They're thought to be at the local Belgrade police station. And there were at least 2 American journalists among them.
Now, has there been a move to call up reserves or enlist young men to join this fight against NATO?
Well, the Yugoslav army has been preparing for this and moving troops around. And I did hear one young Serb man say he wasn't going out on the street tonight because he was afraid of being drafted. That's about as far as we can go with that.
Thanks, Edward. Appreciate it very much. NPR's Edward Lissman talking with us from Belgrade, Yugoslavia.
Yugoslavia's version of what its security forces are doing in Kosovo is combating terrorism, specifically the terrorism of the Kosovo Liberation Army. Some more on that group now. The Kosovo Liberation Army, or the KLA, was founded in the early 1980s. While the mainstream Albanian party in Kosovo, led by Ibrahim Rugova, stood for independence by political means, the KLA called for armed struggle. The British journalist Tim Judah, who has written about the Serbs and Yugoslavia, says the KLA was dismissed by most people in Kosovo as impractical. Armed struggle was impossible in a landlocked province without access to foreign arms. Then, Judah says, something pivotal happened across the border. The economy of Albania collapsed after much of that country's population invested in a pyramid scheme.
What happened was that the opportunity came with the collapse of Albania, the Albanian state, the throwing open of the armories, and so millions of guns were suddenly available at a very cheap price.
You cited a price at one point of a Kalashnikov for $15.
It was $15, but initially they were free. I mean, at one point I was in Albania myself at the time of the collapse, and people were walking in and helping themselves to whatever arms they wanted to take.
So the breakdown of Albania led to the supply of arms being there, of small arms being there for the KLA.
The possibility of arms. It led to it meant that for the first time the Kosovo Liberation Army, or the people who argued for an uprising, could and should be taken seriously, because they said, well, for the first time, you know, we have a secure and affordable supply of arms.
Now, during all those years that people were scoffing at this KLA movement and its political party, there was, in parallel to it, the larger movement of Ibrahim Rugova, which wasn't calling for a guerrilla war.
No, absolutely not. And although the aims were the same, that is to say independence, what Mr. Rugova said was that to start an uprising would be sheer folly, because he said the Serbs would use it as an excuse to ethnically cleanse the province. And people at that time were looking at what was happening in Croatia, they were looking at what was happening in Bosnia. Mr. Rugova said, look, we're going to get our aims in the long run, so it's better not to take up arms, not to risk everything. So, well, history will tell who was right.
Now, in that part of the world, it has been argued before that sometimes the worse things get, the better they get. And if you can make things bad, you'll make out well as a result. And it seems to be working that way. That is, the Albanians of Kosovo, while they're being dealt with horribly on the ground, as we say, are getting a lot more worldwide sympathy for their cause now than they were before.
Well, yes, that's partly right, but it's also a very high-risk strategy because, well, we don't know what the results of the bombing will be. We don't know yet whether, Mr. Milosevic, whether Belgrade will say, okay, you know, we're now going to accept autonomy, et cetera, et cetera, or they're going to say, okay, let's go for it, send in the army, the police, and literally burn the whole of Kosovo down and drive out 1 million Albanians.
If, on the other hand, the KLA were to appear in towns all over Kosovo, come out from into the open, and take advantage of NATO having pushed, let's say, the Serbs out, would they be welcomed by the people? Are they a popular
force? Oh, they would
force?
Certainly be welcomed by the people, absolutely. The question is whether they're strong enough to do it. Now, I was speaking to somebody that I know, KLA's representative here in London, and he was saying that he did not think that that was really going to be feasible, not in the short term.
Has the KLA been an especially brutal force in the attacks it staged?
Well, I wouldn't say it's been especially brutal, but they're not angels either, because, of course, there have been kidnaps and alleged murders of Serb civilians.
Apart from standing for independence from Yugoslavia, does the KLA have any particular ideological principles that it stands for?
Today, no, but it is true that at the very beginning, in the early 80s, the LPK, the popular movement for Kosovo, which was a very important part of the founders of the KLA, espoused some sort of Marxism-Leninism. Perhaps it was because they wanted to get help from the then Marxist Albania. But in a way, that's really completely, it's irrelevant. That's the historical path. As far as the KLA are concerned, all they really want is independence for Kosovo.
Well, Tim Judah, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Tim Judah is the author of The Serbs, History, Myth, and the Destruction of Yugoslavia.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. 6 hours after announcing that NATO airstrikes were underway against Serb military targets, President Clinton spoke to the nation. Mr. Clinton said that action is underway now to prevent a wider war. But he said, as he has before, there are risks.
There are risks in this military action. Risks to our pilots and the people on the ground. Serbia's air defenses are strong. It could decide to intensify its assault on Kosovo or to seek to harm us or our allies elsewhere. If it does, we will deliver a forceful response. Hopefully, Mr. Milosevic will realize his present course is self-destructive and unsustainable. If he decides to accept the peace agreement and demilitarize Kosovo, NATO has agreed to help to implement it with a peacekeeping force. If NATO is invited to do so, our troops should take part in that mission to keep the peace. But I do not intend to put our troops in Kosovo to fight a war.
President Clinton also said it's important to the United States to have a prosperous and secure Europe. Secretary of Defense William Cohen, speaking this afternoon at a Pentagon news conference, said that after the first wave of airstrikes, all U.S. planes returned safely to base. These attacks began shortly after darkness fell in Yugoslavia. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli is in Belgrade, and she spoke of the scene from the rooftop of her hotel.
We were able to see some flashes of orange light, something falling from the sky in different directions, followed by explosive sounds in the distance, and then smoke. This is a bit more like we had heard before that, an air siren. But I have to say the city is still lit up. The traffic, of course, is very light. In front of me there's a gas station, and I can see there's still a long line. There's definitely it's much more quiet, the city, but we've heard that there have been airstrikes again, not only around Belgrade, but also in Pristina, in the capital of Montenegro, Podgorica, along the Montenegrin coast and the Adriatic, and in the city of Novi Sad, which is 50 miles north of Belgrade.
NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reporting from Belgrade. In Moscow, Russian leader Boris Yeltsin said today that he is deeply shocked by NATO bombing attacks on Serb targets in Yugoslavia. Soviet officials have been against these air attacks from the start, and yesterday the Russian prime minister changed course on his way to the United States and returned home after he was told that air attacks might occur during his visit to Washington.
The first wave of NATO airstrikes against Yugoslavia began today, following the failure of diplomacy to reach a peace accord for Kosovo. Yesterday, Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic refused to sign on to an agreement that would have granted Kosovo broad autonomy and would have been enforced by the presence of 28,000 NATO troops. Kosovo is a province of Serbia, Yugoslavia's dominant republic. The province is overwhelmingly ethnic Albanian, and the Kosovo Liberation Army has been fighting for independence there. Today, hours before the airstrikes began, Milosevic went on national television pledging to defend his country by all means. Explosions were reported outside Belgrade, in Pristina, the capital of Kosovo, in the northern Serbian town of Novi Sad, and at an airport in the Yugoslav Republic of Montenegro. The official Yugoslav news agency claims there have been fatalities among family members of former soldiers who were staying in military housing. At NATO headquarters in Brussels, Secretary General Javier Solana emphasized again that the goal of the mission is to bring about a change of policy in Yugoslavia.
NATO is not waging war against Yugoslavia. We have no quarrel with the people of Yugoslavia, who for too long have been isolated in Europe because of the policies of their government. Our actions are directed against the repressive policy of the Yugoslav leadership. We must stop the violence and bring an end to the humanitarian catastrophe now taking place in Kosovo.
NATO Secretary General Javier Solana speaking today in Brussels.
Russia's President Boris Yeltsin has pulled his country out of its partnership with NATO and warned about further protests against the attacks on Yugoslavia. Russia's also called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council to respond to what it sees as illegal NATO aggression. Earlier today, President Clinton called Mr. Yeltsin to try to dampen the anti-NATO rhetoric in Moscow, and NPR's Michelle Kellerman has a report.
The mood in the corridors of power and on the streets of Moscow was overwhelmingly anti-NATO and anti-American. And angry President Boris Yeltsin took to the airwaves after speaking to President Clinton and learning the bombings were inevitable.
Это безопасность Европы. Это война в Европе.
The security of Europe is at stake, Yeltsin said, perhaps even more. Yeltsin said it was incomprehensible that NATO could take such a serious step without getting approval from the UN Security Council. Many other Russian politicians expressed indignation over this issue as well. By sidestepping the UN, NATO sidestepped Russia, a permanent member of the UN Security Council. Russia did have a say in the Kosovo peace talks, though. It's a member of the Six Nation Contact Group, which tried to persuade Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic to sign a peace accord. But even after repeated failures, Yeltsin said there was no reason to give up.
Да, он трудный переговорщик. Да, с ним надо...
Yes, Milosevic is a difficult man, Yeltsin said. You have to negotiate with him 5 or even 10 times. But the Russian president argued it is worth talking to Milosevic again and again in order to save the lives of hundreds of people who could die in the bombings. Just how far Russia will go to support Milosevic remains a hotly disputed issue. Communist and nationalist politicians want to offer Yugoslavia military help, or at least fuel, to survive NATO aggression. Others argue Milosevic has not been a worthy partner, and Russian policy in the Balkans has failed because of this. But even the politicians who believe this are dead set against NATO airstrikes. Lawmaker Alexei Arbatov warns the strikes could have far-reaching consequences for Russia's relations with NATO and the United States.
Military cooperation, arms control negotiations, cooperation on non-proliferation of nuclear weapons, all those questions which require a lot of goodwill and support from Russia would be severely hampered by this decision of NATO.
These were all issues Prime Minister Yevgeny Primakov was due to discuss with the Clinton administration this week before he abruptly called off his trip to Washington. Yabloko party leader Grigory Yavlinsky described Primakov's decision as a theatrical gesture which could hurt Russia's chances for more aid from the West. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
An update now on the day's top story. U.S. warships and bombers fired cruise missiles at Serb targets today. There were explosions in Pristina, in Belgrade, in the northern Serbian town of Novi Sad, and in the Republic of Montenegro. The attacks are the start of what U.S. officials say will be a sustained NATO missile and bombing campaign in Yugoslavia. At the White House, President Clinton said that NATO had no choice but to begin airstrikes after Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic rejected diplomatic efforts to end the fighting in Kosovo between Serbs and ethnic Albanians.